the first, I think, thing to say is, if it feels right, it probably is right. And that blows away a whole lot of the myths.
Diz Runs Radio, episode 444, starts in 3, 2. Welcome back to Diz Runs Radio, where I talk with runners from all corners of the running world about running, life, and everything in between. I'm your host, Denny Cray, and it's just about time to head out the door for an easy run and a great conversation. So if you're ready, then I'm ready. Let's get started. Hey guys, today's episode of the show is sponsored by runningshoesguru.com. If you're looking for kind of an honest review, honestly, I mean, that's the big thing about the website, is all kinds of honest reviews about literally all kinds of different shoes. So, you know, if you're looking for maybe trying a different style of shoe, or you know, if there's a new model of a shoe out there that you want to get an update on, like, all right, so how does this compare to the old version? RunningShoesGuru.com is the resource. So definitely check it out. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later on. But now, let's go ahead and get on with today's episode of the show. Hey guys, my guest today is a lifelong runner that has done just about everything in the running industry. He was the editor of Running Times magazine from 2000 to 2015. He coaches high school cross country. He knows running shoes inside and out, and he has written more quality running articles than I could probably count if I wanted to. He is also the author of a newly released book, Your Best Stride: How to Optimize Your Natural Running Form to Run Easier, Farther, and Faster with Fewer Injuries. And he's already working on his next book, which is titled Run Strong, Stay Hungry, which is set to be released later this fall. And somehow, in the midst of all that, he's finding time today to stop by for a few easy miles with me. So without any further ado, it is my pleasure to be able to welcome Mr. Jonathan Beverly to the show. Thanks for joining us today, Jonathan.
It's my pleasure. It's really great to be here.
Well, good. The pleasure is definitely all mine. And guys, if you want to check out more of what Jonathan's got going on, and definitely there's links to all of those articles that I said I couldn't probably count. So I guess maybe I probably could have counted them. But there's tons and tons and tons of articles and info on the books and a whole bunch of things at his website, which you can just find it real easy, jonathanbeverly.com. And that's in case you're wondering on the spelling on Jonathan, because sometimes there can be a little bit of confusion there. J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Beverly, B-E-V-E-R-L-Y. .com. And on the Twitter, on the Instagram, same handle both places, although more active on Twitter probably than Instagram, at JBevRun, all one conglomeration of 7 whole letters right there. So saving some spaces on Twitter, which is always good as well. And as per usual, as you would guess, we'll have the links to everything that we talk about in today's episode in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at dizruns.com/444. So Jonathan, the way we always start off the show is with a simple and straightforward question that sometimes has a simple and straightforward answer, and sometimes it's a little bit of a head scratcher and something that gives us lots of things to talk about over the course of the next, you know, 30, 40, 50 minutes, whatever we end up being at today. But that's just to simply ask, what is your favorite distance to race and why?
All right. Well, I have a simple answer, but it'll give us plenty to talk about.
Perfect.
And that is 10 miles is my favorite race distance. It's an unusual race distance. So the why is, the first reason is true about any race from like 15K to half marathon, is that it is the only distance in my experience that if you're well prepared for it, you can race your best race and enjoy most of that race. Mm-hmm. If you're racing a 5K, well, about half mile in, you start hurting and you
right.
and you hurt for the rest of the way. And if you're racing a marathon, well, you're in the throes of fatigue for the last 6 at least.
Mm-hmm.
Anything at 10 mile to half marathon range, it's right at that threshold, right at your aerobic threshold. And if you're prepared well, you're cruising. You're running faster than you can imagine, and miles are just going by, and you're feeling great. And it gets long, and it gets, you know, it's like, okay, I've got to keep my foot on that pedal, right on the red line. But it's not agony. It's just an amazing feeling of flying. So that's why that range is my favorite. The 10 mile particularly, I think, is just fun. One thing, like, you know, if you run 7 minute miles, it's a 70, you know, mm-hmm. the math is easy. It makes sense. It's just a fun distance. And probably another reason is that one of the first races I ever ran, road races, was the Tour du Lac 10 mile in Bucksport, Maine. That's where I went to high school. And so that was my introduction to road racing, was that distance around Tour du Lac around the lake.
Gotcha. Yeah. The 10 mile is an answer that we get every once in a while, but it's, at least for me down here, there's not a whole lot of options to run, you know, locally. There's not a whole lot of 10 mile distances. So it's a race I've run a couple times and I've enjoyed it as well.
Yeah.
And would love to see more of them, but it's just like, I mean, the half mile or the half marathon, they pop up everywhere, and that 10 mile kind of gets, has gotten lost in the shuffle a little bit.
Exactly. So the half marathon will suffice.
Right.
But when you find them, it's fun. There's one in Denver I did a couple years after I became a master. And again, you pop a good one and it feels great. And you say, wow, yeah, this is, you feel fit, you feel good. And you've run a good race.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you've been training for a half marathon, it's one of those, you know, probably where it's kind of over and you're like, wait a minute, like, all right, 10 miles, like I'm already done. Instead of that, having to throw that extra 5K on there, like you're maybe used to.
Exactly. And for that reason, for most people, it is more, you know, the threshold pace, your ventilatory threshold or aerobic threshold is about an hour. And, mm-hmm. and that's more closer, 10 miles closer. I mean, half marathon is getting you into a long race. And,
right.
and particularly if you're going slower than that, I mean, some people are doing 2 hours. It's an endurance race, not a threshold race.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and obviously, you know, we've got lots of folks listening from all ends of the spectrum. So there's some that are definitely at the threshold on the half marathon and the 10 miles certainly, and there's some that definitely run a little bit longer. I'm probably in a little bit longer range. I'm in that 140, 145 range with the half marathon. So one, I don't know, whatever that works out to be, 115, 120, something like that, I think 115 was my last 10 mile was. So
right.
it's a
close.
Nice blend. Yeah, it's a nice blend of a distance.
Yeah.
So, we mentioned in the intro that you've been in and around running pretty much your whole life, and you talked about running the first 10 mile race back, you know, in your hometown where you grew up. How did you get into running? I mean, was that something that in that area, or just was something that was in your family, or how did you find the sport to begin with?
I would say it's the usual reason. For one, I was the youngest child. I had a brother 2 years older than me that was both 2 years older and much more athletically oriented. I was a little nerd. I skipped a grade in third grade. And so, you know, by the time I got to high school, it was very clear I was not going to be a football player or a basketball player or any other sport. But I did know I had some tenacity and endurance. And I'm not sure exactly why I went out, but I went out for cross country and fell in love. Away. And we did 5 miles first day, sort of by accident. The freshmen were supposed to turn around and we missed the turnaround. So we did the full course that the varsity was doing and of course couldn't sit down for a week, but I recovered and quickly found that the longer I went, the better I did. So much though, I told you about running that race. My coach, I had a really good coach. It was 1970s, late 70s in Maine, which was a running mecca. You know, Joan Benoit was from there and Bill, you know, New England.
Right.
But she was into the whole set running, you know, the whole running scene of the first running boom and encouraged people just to run, not, you know, it wasn't all about just track and success, but just loving running. And she started taking me to road races in the summer. I did a 16 miler. This summer, the end of the summer between my sophomore and junior year, and just cruised the whole way. I mean, 7 minute miles, it's like, yeah, this is no big deal. I mean, sort of like I was talking about, you know, thresholds. So. Mm-hmm. So the next spring, I trained and ran a marathon at 16 years old, and I've loved it ever since. And it's just been something I've not only the, you know, because I could have success in it, but I love the whole process. I love getting out and away. I love being alone and moving and everything about running.
So a little, you know, one of the things I love about the show, and like I was telling before we started recording, is that I don't really have a set guideline or set you know, list of questions where I want to go, and I love to be able to take a little tangent. And what you just said, I would love to dive into it a little bit more if you don't mind. The fact that you started running and ran, you know, longer distances and even a marathon at a fairly young age, at least, you know, here in the States, as far as what we kind of consider quote unquote the normal, you know, how old should you be, that question of how old is, or how young is too young to train for a marathon. I know I get it a lot and I'm sure you've gotten it dozens of times as well, but could we get into that just a little bit of You know, first of all, in your mind, in your experience, in the research and the, you know, the years in the sport and everything that, that you've seen, is there a point when if a kid wants to run a marathon and they train well and they, you know, they're gradual progression and all that kind of good stuff, is there a point where too young is too young, or is that kind of one of those mythical questions that there isn't a set age or a, right. I don't want to say, you know, a rule of thumb, because I'm not a big one size fits all type of thing, but you know what I'm saying? Like how do we,
yes.
When somebody asks that question of us as runners, how should we respond to that?
I actually did some extensive research on this, wrote an article called, I think it's called Should Kids Go Long or something to that effect. I mean, that's on my website. Actually, despite that extensive list on my website, that's not all of them. That's just the ones I like.
I figured there had to be way more than that. And as long as it is.
But kids going long, I think that's what I called it. But anyway, I talked to a lot of physicians, coaches, and the bottom line is there is absolutely no reason kids are better suited to go long than they are to go fast, that until you're fully developed, testosterone kicks in and things, you have more likely to get injured going hard or lifting hard than going long. Endurance is something you're born with, but you have to build up to yourself. Like Arthur Lydiard said, 12-year-olds should be doing 20-mile weeks. And I think there's probably some truth to that when you look at the distance powers to today from East Africa that they are doing about,
right.
6 to 20 miles a day, very slowly, just a comfortable pitter patter, but they've done it all their lives. And so, as you said, the key is that it's a gradual buildup, just like for adults, and that they want to do it. Where I get into the article, the simple answer is no. There's no reason a kid can't run a marathon. The complex answer is should they, and who's motivating it? Who's pushing it? And that's where you see the, I think, sad stories are those that either, got a parent with a foot in the middle of their back, or they just, or they've gotten the idea that they have to do this somehow. It's a self-esteem issue. This is where, their identity is wrapped around this, and they're going harder and longer than they should or that they want to anymore, but they don't know how to get out.
Gotcha. That's always kind of been the way I've gone with that answer, but I didn't have, it's from reading different articles and things like that from, that led me in that direction. But I know you had done way more research than I had. And obviously, and you've lived it. I mean, I wasn't a runner when I was in middle school and high school. So I didn't run my first marathon until I was, I don't know what I would, 20, 26, 27, something like that. I can't draw back on my experience and say, well, I did it when I was 15, 16 years old and I'm still fine. Cause you always hear everybody, oh, if they run too many miles at that young age, they're going to be injured for life and they're not gonna be able to run anymore. And I just, I don't see it. And I've talked to folks that have, and I'm glad to have gotten a little bit more, from your perspective and the research you've done. And we'll certainly link to that article in the show notes as well. If people want to pass that around and help to have some ammunition to go into that conversation with some actual good research, not just, I think I heard this on the internet at one point, but it's actually legitimate stuff. So thank you.
Let me continue for that a second, is that my second book that you mentioned there, Run Strong, Stay Hungry, that we're just putting final proofing on right now. I interviewed over 50 people who started as youth and are still competing in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and pulled out 9 principles. One of the things that isn't one of the 9 principles, but sort of a sidebar that ties into it, is that surprising number of those, I think about 60% of them ran a marathon in high school, and then they're still running at 70. That there are reasons I think it's actually good, because it both psychologically and physically prepares you for going on as a runner.
Mm-hmm. And also, again, continues to add more leverage to those of us who constantly have to deal with the barrage of, you shouldn't run because it's going to ruin your knees or it's going to ruin your hips. You're not going to be able to walk when you're 50 years old if you start running too early. And it's not quite the case.
No, exactly.
So, but before we get into, I definitely want to get into to the new book or the book that is out already, Your Best Stride. But before we get into that, a couple other things I'd love to touch on a little bit. I first, was exposed to you from reading Running Times. It was my go-to running magazine for I don't know. I probably subscribed to it for 5 or 6 years. The last 5 or 6 years that the magazine was in existence. How did you get did you get into that phase? So you started off, you know, running and falling in love with the sport young. Where did the writing and the publishing and you know, kind of getting into to make running part of, you know, your career, your not only your passion for something to do as an enjoyment and leisure and recreation, but also kind of what puts food on the table and the roof over the head as well?
Yeah, good question. And I that was as accidental as becoming an athlete. I never set out to be an editor or a writer for that matter. I didn't study journalism. I studied international studies, international education. And although I always enjoyed writing, and I won an essay contest in college and bought my first car, which was only like $2,000. So I don't think it was that big an essay contest, but it was still enough to make me think, yeah, I can do this. And kept journals. But over the course of time, I did things in international studies, you know, directed youth programs in Panama and lived in Venezuela. My wife did her thesis there, taught English there. And then I was working, directing international exchange programs at NYU. And while my wife was working as a consultant there with PricewaterhouseCoopers and started coaching with Bob Glover at the New York Roadrunners Club in New York and getting stories out. Just I had extra time and mental space. And so just started writing for lots of people. The first one actually was a 1992 back page of Runner's World. It was just, you know, it used to be a reader submitted essay. And then I started writing for lots of local people. I mean, the typical story to be a writer, it's kind of like a musician or something else. You got to get known. So you just got to get stuff out there. So New York Roadrunners Club, Footnotes, RRCA newsletter, and that doesn't exist anymore. And trying for the big ones. I got a couple. I wrote the back page of the 100th Boston Marathon edition. It's still one of my favorite essays, called Once Each Spring, where I compared, for Boston Marathoners, people who've never lived in Boston, it only exists. It's like Brigadoon. It appears once each spring. You know, Boston only exists for me on that day, and it's perfect that day. And I don't want to know any way else. You know, I only want to know Boston exists on Patriots Day. So, so anyway, that was about the time when writing took off, because I had sent an essay to Runner's World. It had gotten rejected by a sub editor. But then it got published in Footnotes, and Ambie Burfoot saw it. It was a humorous piece about running with your significant other and all the pitfalls of running with somebody you love. And he loved the piece, and he said, "Are you going to Boston?" And that was, I had the piece in the back of there, and so he met me at the Runner's World party in Boston that year, took me aside and said, "You know, I don't know what you're doing for a career, and writing's a terrible life, but you could do that if you wanted to." So I started sending stuff to him and had feature stories published, and that took off enough that when my wife got a chance to live in Belgium, I quit my day job and wrote full time for 2 years in Belgium. At the end of that, I had been working enough with Gordon Bakulis, was the editor of Running Times then. She's since went on, and she's been with New York Roadrunners since 2000. But she wanted to step down. She just had a baby and wanted to step down for Running Times and asked me if I would take over. So I went straight to being editor in chief.
Wow.
And 2000. Yeah, it was a fun time. And then I hired Mark Shalifour, who was a runner from Haverford, just out of college. And the two of us pretty much had fun. We just, you know, we taught ourselves how to edit a magazine for a while there.
Wow. That's a great story. What are, and you know, this is probably an impossible question. I recognize when I'm going to ask a bad question before I ask it, and preface with that. And then I still go ahead and ask the question anyway, but, you know, from your time at Running Times, from all of the hundreds of articles that were written that you have read through, you know, and all of the issues, the people you've had to talk or been able to talk to, the elites, the sub elites, whoever it may be that you come across, are there a couple of things that really stand out from your time there that were just like, man, like that was really cool experience, whether it's a trip, whether it's interview, whether it's just a chat on the side, whatever it was? Are there a few things that stand out, or are there just too many to even begin to narrow it down?
Well, there's certainly plenty, right? And there's ones, you know, that I mean of other people's things that we published. Actually, two stories in Kenya, the Kenyan runners I was really proud of. Scott Douglas went once, and it was just, as you know, Scott, former Running Times editor and writer, is just very insightful. And then Philip Latter, who's now become a writer, he's got a book on flow. He went to Kenya too. And I felt like both of those, I think we did a good job of capturing beyond the, you know, oh, aren't they amazing people? And, you know, that to sort of the gritty reality of what it's like to have grown up there in the culture, and the good and the bad of being part of that running culture. Personally, probably the most amazing story was, I did a story, Constantina Tomescadita. She won Chicago in what year? Probably 2010 or so.
Okay.
And she's competed several times, and I've always been impressed with how gutsy she is. And also then, you know, sort of this feeling of, you know, people had never seen a story on her. And I think part of the reason is, you know, anybody with the name Tomescoditu sort of is one of this anonymous Eastern Bloc runner, you know, but she was living in Boulder. And, so I live near Boulder. I drove out and did a profile on her and her husband, Valero Tomesco. And then when she won gold in Beijing, she called me from the airport and said, we want you to have the exclusive story of this last year and how this happened, how I ended up winning gold. So again, I got to spend a few days with them and it was a very interesting story because a lot of sort of personal, that they had gotten divorced and she had coached herself and coached somebody else. And then she hired him back, her ex-husband, to coach her to the Olympics. Yeah. And then just the whole, and then strategy of it, you know, she's known to be a front runner. So people, you know, let her go. Mm-hmm. But at that time they let her go, but she wasn't being crazy front runner. Everybody being so conservative in the heat, you know, she was just pacing herself.
Right. Wow, that is just the Cliff Notes version of it. Just here is a crazy story and something that I'm sure would be a great, you know, just a fun thing to be a part of, to you know, have the conversations and watch it play out on the Olympics, and then, you know, discussing it after the fact would be really cool.
It was cool.
Yeah, definitely. But before we, I like I said, I want to get into the book, but there's one other thing on my list that I really want to touch on, at least briefly, and that's running shoes. You know, you talk about on the website and in your Twitter bio, you know, you only have a handful of characters. People always have to put in the most important things, and you definitely put on there that you know quite a bit about running shoes, and obviously with your time in the sport, I mean, you know, the shoe technology has changed and ebbed and flowed and you know, taken a 180 and then take another 180 and who knows where we are right now. So without getting into every different model and brand and type, are there, you know, again, keeping this a little bit broad, which I know isn't always the best way to ask a question, but without going too deep into the running shoes weeds, because that could be about a 4-day discussion, I'm sure. What are a couple of things that for the average runner who's serious about the sport, but, you know, like isn't so far down into looking at everything. So like somebody who's maybe been running for a couple of years and they're looking for the right kind of shoe, and they, you know, they're getting conflicting reports of, do I want a stability shoe? Do I want something that's full cushion, zero drop or whatever, all the different, you know, buzzwords that are out there in the shoe world. What are a couple of things in your mind as somebody who's studied it, researched it, worn dozens of different types and styles of shoes and things of that nature that are maybe the most, I don't know, misunderstood or myths or untruths that are floating around there as accepted, you know, quote unquote fact in the running community that you just kind of shake your head at and go, come on guys, like we are missing the point on this.
That's a great question. And by the way, there is a chapter in the book about this. So this is a good segue to the book.
But, yes.
And so the first, I think, thing to say is, if it feels right, it probably is right. And that blows away a whole lot of the myths, which, you know, I think the biggest myth that everybody seems to have aired, you know, from almost the beginning of running is that, one, running shoes can correct you, that, you know, if you have a certain weakness, just get the right shoe. I mean, people come to you, they probably come to you. They come to anybody who's been a runner or seen an expert, you know, I want to start running but I got weak knees. What shoes should I wear? You know, or I've been running for a little while and my, you know, my Achilles always hurt. What shoes should I wear? And I mean, the accepted answer is the shoe is going to fix you.
Right.
And the research, you know, from the people, the top people in the world who've been doing this research, you know, Ben O'Neig is one of them. He's a Swiss guy who's researched at University of Calgary for years. He wrote the book Biomechanics of Sports Shoes. He says, you know, 50 years ago he started and all he wanted to do was prove what level of pronation is dangerous and how to correct that. And he says 50 years later, he hasn't found that answer. There is no. In fact, he says we should get away from the whole idea of pronation. And Simon Bartold, another biomechanist podiatrist, he says, you know, we have this pronationism where you have people come back from the, oh no, you know, from the shoe store. I've been diagnosed as a pronator and my life is over, you know, and I have to wear Brooks Beast for the rest of my life.
Right.
So the shoe can't correct you. And then minimalism went the other way. It was a valid correction, but the pendulum swung too far and said the shoe can fix you, that if you put on the right shoe, then your stride will automatically change and you'll run perfectly. Both of those are myths. What Ben O'Neig has found is he's done research that the shoe you put on, you go out and you run in it. And he calls it the comfort filter. But I think comfort might not have been the best term because people think comfort as you know, squishy luxury, right. You know, sort of cushion. What he means is it falls right. It works right. There, I once saw an ad for Honda, and I keep trying to look this up, but there's supposed to be a Japanese term that says things that fall right. You know, you drop it and it lands the way you want it to land, you know, so you close the car door and it sounds just the way you want it to sound. That's what you're talking about. That the shoe falls right. Yeah. It touches down where you expect it to touch down. It rolls the way you want it to roll. It flexes where you want it to roll. The proprioception of the ground, you know, a little bit of cushion, but enough to push off. You know, it's like, yes, you know, it's, you don't notice the shoe's there.
Right.
That's the shoe for you. Regardless of what anybody says, you know, the store clerk or the podiatrist says you need a, you know, heavy motion control shoe and you put on a neutral, you know, racing flat and it feels right. That's probably the right shoe. And he found that Ben O'Neig found in research with pretty large studies that if you choose it by comfort, you run more efficiently and you're more less likely to get injured than a prescribed shoe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is pretty huge. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's exactly kind of where I've fallen into. And I think it was through trial and error. And thankfully for me, I've gotten into, or I've, you know, in that process, there was not a whole lot of serious error. You know, there were a few missteps, a few, you know, chasing the ads or the promises that sometimes are out there with, you know, this shoe will make all the difference. And, you know,
right.
Without knowing it, it sounds like I kind of did exactly what I was supposed to with the comfort test. And just, it doesn't feel right. Like this isn't, I'm fighting against myself and if, you know, keep trying different things and find out what works best for you.
Right. Having said that, you know, I gave all the examples sort of against a motion control shoe. There are people that feels right. And if it feels right, then go for it. Don't believe the person who says you have to be in a minimalist shoe. You know, that no, if it works for you. Now, the one thing that all the experts agree on also is that you want to wear the least shoe that you can get away with. I mean, so yeah, it feels good for you. And if you can work towards less shoe, or you can put on a less shoe and it still feels good, go with the less shoe. That the less shoe for numbers reasons. I mean, just a lighter shoe makes you more efficient. Mm-hmm. And less shoe strengthens your foot muscles and is more like your stride will work better. It doesn't hinder parts of your stride, but you can run effectively in a Brooks Beast, to use the example
right.
I used. If that's that the shoe isn't the problem, neither the solution nor the problem. Really, we give them much too much credit.
Right, and probably too much blame. On the flip side, you know, if something goes wrong, it's the shoe's fault. And like, well, no, like that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, and I mean, I still do. I mean, I've run it for 40 years, and yeah, I trained for a marathon this spring for the first time in 9 years, 8 years. I don't know. Yeah, but you know, ramping up, I started to get some pains in my shin, and It's like, oh, well, I guess I better wear the cushion shoe the next day. No, that's not going to make the difference. You know, in fact, for me, if I wear a really heavy cushion shoe, I put more strain on it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a balance issue or something, but you get this, these voices in your head that, if you got a little pain, then you should put more cushion on.
Yeah. Right. Right. And that's a good segue, like you said, into the book. I do want to get into that. But first, real quick, to pay a couple bills. Guys, again, this episode is sponsored by the good folks over at Running Shoes Guru, which is also a good kind of segue into this. Like, they're not out there at runningshoesguru.com. They're not out there trying to tell you which shoe is best. It's just all reviews of literally hundreds of different shoes. So, if you're looking at maybe trying a different shoe and you want, a firsthand, unbiased account of what, what this shoe is like, how thick is it? What's the heel to toe drop ratio? Is it stability? Is it neutral? What's the upper feel like? All those kind of things are all the things that the reviewers at Running Shoes Guru gurus.com. Let me say that again, runningshoesguru.com. What they talk about there. And again, hundreds of different types of shoes. And if you go there and looking for a specific shoe and it's not there, go ahead and email them and let them know. And we'll see if they can't get a pair of shoes on a reviewer quick and get that information out to you. So check it out. Thanks to runningshoesguru.com for sponsoring today's episode. So Jonathan, definitely, like I said, want to transition to the book. I'm loving it. I've only been reading it for a few days and having a hard time putting it down. My first impression, I want to give you some kudos for this is, it's talking from where the parts that I've gotten into yet, and just from thumbing through it as well. This book real easily could become, I don't want to say tedious, but it, a lot of technical stuff on how to run better, how to improve your stride, different exercises, things of that nature that you can do and should do to become a better runner. And we'll get into all this as we go. But I just want to say that so far it's very interesting and entertaining, which I think that this very easily could skew the other direction where it just became so technical that it would be hard to read. So very well done with as much as I've read so far, and definitely looking forward to keep going. All that to say, or tell us a little bit, kind of where did this book come from? Your best stride. What was it that got you or inspired you to write this book? Who's it for? All those kind of things for those that are listening that haven't heard of it yet or haven't picked up a copy yet. What's the book about? And we'll go from there.
Thanks. Yeah, it started with what you're talking about right here. Having seen all of these shoe technologies come and go, all the trends come and go. I mean, as editor, you get every query from people, and form is one of these things that from the beginning you get some real quacks, I have to admit, that say, I've discovered the secret, and if everybody runs the way I say, they'll never have injury and they'll be faster. And most of them are quacks. I mean, they anybody who says they have the one answer is probably wrong, because everybody is different. With minimalism was probably the biggest mainstream movement as far as form, and I pretty much bought into minimalism, both having seen, like I said, the elite runners, and knowing that most of them grew up barefoot. Even Benita Johnson, her name is now, from Australia, but she won the World Cross Country in 2004. I was there and I interviewed her afterwards. She's the first Westerner to win in 10 years or so. And she said, I grew up barefoot on the beach in Australia. And it's like, okay, well, there's something to this barefoot. And I do think there is. But and there was some corrections, as I said, that needed to be done to say people that there is something wrong with how most of us are running. One, that we look different than the elite. So they run... The whole pattern is different than a jogger, you'd say, and it's not just faster. There's something here, and two, that people are getting injured all the time, and or need really big, heavy corrective shoes that are kind of a brace or a crutch, that our body shouldn't need that. So those things were true. Where minimalism went off course was over promising. You take off your shoes or you put on minimal shoes and you're automatically going to be better. People weren't automatically better. They were hurt, in different ways and often more severely. And so when that went out the window, 2013, the Vibram lawsuit, people just, gleefully throwing it away. See, they were all wrong. I'm fine. And the other thing minimalism did was made it all a test of, you heel striker was like learning impaired, you mm-hmm. dumb heel striker, And so when they were proven wrong, people were like, hey, I'm a heel striker. I'm proud of it. You were wrong all along. Mm-hmm. I felt like there was this vacuum, Okay. So now are we really going to go back, 5 years to just saying everybody should wear the Kayano 17 and the Adrenaline 23, you know, right. and nothing, there was nothing true about what we were learning here, because I did think we were learning a few things. So I started interviewing people. I just said, gave myself a project to say, if I interviewed biomechanists, podiatrists, coaches, physical therapists, particularly some really brilliant ones, like Jay Dashari is, he wrote the book Anatomy for Runners, but he has really both had a grasp on the biomechanics and the practical, you know, coaching mm-hmm. people and treating people who have pathologies, to say, what's going on here? Is there something that they all agree on that we all can do to run better, you know, not individually? And what I found is they all agree, one, that people are individuals, that along with, you know, this whole idea that your brain knows best, what feels best is best for shoes, the same thing in your stride, that your body optimizes your physical characteristics, your leg lengths, your stiffness of your joints, the way your muscle moves, in order to run with the least effort possible, the most mm-hmm. efficient way possible. I mean, it's water flowing down a mountain, you know, that it will find the best path, and your body will find the best path, and you shouldn't necessarily mess with that. That's where the form gurus tend to go off, is that they say, okay, no, everybody should land this way. Everybody arm angle should be exactly this. Everybody should do, and then we'll all be perfect. You know, we'll all look like Kenenisa Bekele. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, we won't, because we're not Kenenisa Bekele. and we intuitively know this, that there is a stride signature. I mean, if you're in Central Park meeting somebody to run, and you're 100 runners are going by, a mile away, you can see your running buddy, mm-hmm. if you know, based on their stride, because their stride is unique. And it should be unique. Our voices are unique. So if that's the case, then there's no need for a book, right? Just go run.
Right.
So the second thing that people agreed upon is that while our bodies have this preferred movement path, that path is based on the body we have now. And the body we have now, most of us as adults growing up in America or Europe, is not the body that we started out with. Mm-hmm. You watch a 4-year-old in a playground, they want to go across the playground. They just jump up and levitate. You know, there's just this beautiful stride, you know, just whoosh. And then you start coaching a 9-year-old in soccer, and something's happened in between. And what's happened, according to these experts, is that they started sitting for most mm-hmm. of the day. That's the first thing. Sitting and hunching are the two things of our society that have really compromised our bodies. So that's what the book is about, is that then we get, I have, what happens is that you end up with some muscles that are shortened and over tightened, and some that are turned off because the range of motion doesn't engage them anymore. Mm-hmm. And then postural things, that our balance is off, our upper body is, our arm swing is off because things are too short. You can't physically actually get there. Or if you can get there, it's strained. Now, if you pull your mother telling you, sit up straight, you know, mm-hmm. you sit up straight and you pull your shoulders back and it feels uncomfortable. It doesn't feel natural because you've been the other way.
Hunched over. But if right.
Until you get into that posture, you can't stride effectively. So the biggest one is hip flexors get over tight in the front because mm-hmm. they've been, rather than being straight or even extended farther, you know, the knee behind the hip, that's a natural running motion. Mm-hmm. It's straight to extended.
Right.
Most of the time our knees are all the way, you know, 90 degree or more in front of us. And so if you can't actually get behind your hip, your only option is to reach in front, land, mm-hmm. and then pull back to zero. That's sort of the, you know, the classic, a little bit sitting posture, jogging stride is reach out, land on the heel, then pull back using a hamstring, you know, to sort of beneath you, and mm-hmm. then go and keep doing that. If you watch an elite runner, they're tall, there's a straight line from shoulder to ankle, and they land close to their body and then drive the leg back behind them. Mm-hmm. And the stride is a long pushing motion. It's not a question of learning that, it's letting your body, you got to get your body able to do that, both in flexibility and strength. And so the book gives tests for that and exercises and for hips, and then for upper body, because you need to get your arms behind your body as well. And they're hardly ever that way. You know, we're reaching in front of ourselves. We're typing, we're driving, we're doing everything out in front of us.
So, you know, obviously we don't have time, first and foremost, to go through every exercise, everything that's in the book. And obviously we don't want to give everything away. I mean, it is too much to give away. Like, let's be honest. It's a great book. Definitely encourage getting it, checking it out, reading it. And I love that, you know, even what you just said, and it's the very beginning of the book, all talks about how, you know, everybody's going to have their own individual, like you said, running signature. And I as soon as I read that, and as soon as you mentioned it again today, you know, I can think about the people I run with. We run it at, you know, between 5 and 5:30 in the morning most mornings, so it's dark, and you can still from 100 yards away, when you can barely make out the silhouette, you can pretty much tell, oh, that's so and so, that's Beth, and that's Greg, and that's whoever, because you know we know how they look. So everybody's going to be individualized, but there are still things that we can do to optimize. So I would love to ask maybe just a couple more questions on some generic things or some general things that you know, that maybe would have the biggest impact for some folks. So the first thing on my mind is, like you said, with the hip flexors being tight from sitting too much, whether it's at work, whether it's in the car, whether it's on the couch watching TV, whatever the case might be. Let me back up. Is it as simple as just trying to stand more? I mean, is getting a standing desk, is that beneficial? Is standing at home to watch TV, as awkward as that might sound, is that something that's going to help us as runners to just not be sitting that much? And it's something that simple as a place to start?
A two-part answer. One is that's certainly going to help. That's going to help not exacerbate the problem. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you've been sitting since you were 4 in preschool means that your hip flexors are probably over tight and shortened. So you're actually going to have to do the stretches and some work to get them to their proper length and full range of motion, even if you started standing all the time now. Second, the part of that is that most of the time, a lot of people can't, you know, you can't mm-hmm. show up to a business meeting and everybody's sitting around the conference table and says, I'll just stand over here. Yeah. And, or students in school or, I mean, for that matter, you know, at night, yeah, in the living room watching the baseball game, yeah, you're going to tick off your wife pretty badly.
Right.
You know, if you stand the whole time. So I think that the exercises and some of the corrections we do are sort of like brushing our teeth. I mean, Dennis Lieberman, who wrote the original Born to Run, he wrote a book called The Story of the Human Body. And he talks about things like this. And he says, you know, like if we had the diet that we were about to eat, we wouldn't have tooth decay, mm-hmm. but we really can't change to whatever that diet was. So we brush our teeth, you know, we do the correction. And I think that's the way you should look at this is, you know, as much as possible. I mean, during this interview, I'm standing and actually mm-hmm. doing sort of a hip flexor stretch here, one leg on a chair and talking. I've gotten some of those habits, but yeah, mostly it's finding a time in the day or, you know, either before and after you run or other times. And one thing you can do that I've tried to do, and I encourage kids I coach, you know, if you are sitting there watching TV on the couch, during the commercial, you know, jump off. That'd be, you know, that's the cue. Jump off and do the couch stretch, which is mm-hmm. where you put back leg on the stretch and front leg sort of in lunge position and get tall and get that hip flexor stretched out. You know, just some things, just regularly working to get that range of motion and cue the glutes on the back to be activated and strong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is that kind of if we were, you know, again, if we were going to boil it down to, and this is another impossible question. I'm on a roll with these today. Yeah. You know, if we were going to say the one thing that the majority of runners, again, recognizing that there's not a one size fits all, but a lot of runners would benefit the most from, it's stretching out the quads and the hip flexors. Is that, you know,
yep.
dumbing it down enough? Is that basically it?
That's basically it. And it seems too simple, you know, and again, we talked about a whole book on form that now there are others, there's foot strengthening exercises, right. There's, you know, upper body, but if there, you know, if you're going to do one thing and in fact, I mean, this is a quote from 10 people in the book, you know, ranging from coach of the Nike Oregon Project to Andrew Castor to, you know, the podiatrist that, you know, if you're going to do one thing, get your hip flexors lengthened. Okay. Yeah. Get your hip flexors loose and lengthened because as soon as that happens, and you know, in conjunction, and mm-hmm. this is the thing I say in the book, there's still like four things that can happen simultaneously, but you know, you can't do any of them without getting hip flexors loosened. And then once that happens, then you can get your hips rotated. You can get your posture back mm-hmm. to, you know, balanced over your hips and over the balls of your feet. You can get your leg moving backwards rather than forward. And so the glute can activate and you can be pushing rather than rolling. Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of that, I would say, so if you're only going to do two things, one is to get your hip flexors loose, and two is to add variety to your workout. Make sure you're doing a lot of different things, mm-hmm. both different speeds, different surfaces, different shoes, barefoot striders, drills, things that shake up your range of motion and muscles mm-hmm. that are recruited, because that's the other side of this preferred movement path and your body finding its best path. Is it once it finds its best path, it kind of locks into that. Yeah, because that's the easiest, and the neuromuscular pathways get in grooved. You know, again, the water flowing down the mountain eventually mm-hmm. becomes a narrow deep channel, and so even when you change something, it wants to stay in that channel. So you gotta shake it up, and make it realize that, hey, you know, barefoot striders, you realize, oh, yeah, this is activating different muscles. This is flowing a little bit differently, and. You have changed the parameters, and so the body can then change its pattern, movement pattern.
Mm-hmm. One last question on the book, and then we'll wrap things up for today. But and this can be a quick one, but you've mentioned it a couple times, and it's something that I've mentioned several times, and you know, I still, you know, still run into people, whether it's people that I coach for runners or just, you know, on social media or whatever, that don't recognize the importance of doing some upper body strengthening as well. Cause you know, I mean, the common perception is we're runners. It's a lower body activity. You know, we forget about the fact that our arms are swinging just as much as our legs are swinging. You know, the quick version, if it is a quick version, I know there's information in this in the book as mm-hmm. well, but, why should we as runners from your perspective, your opinion, your research, why should we mm-hmm. care about upper body strengthening as well, to help us in our training and on race day?
Well, the very quick answer is that it affects balance and rhythm significantly. What your arms do, your legs follow. Mm-hmm. And so if your arms are, you know, your shoulders are hunched and your arms are in front of your body, your whole balance is going to be that way and your legs are going to be. So, I mean, again, arm swing and hand carriage and stuff is something that varies with individual. And I don't think you can or should change that, except for if it's wrong. And where it's wrong is if it's in front of your body and if it's going back and forth across your body. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at any elite runner, you'll see that their arm comes back. The arm drive is entirely back. That's the drive is from, you know, from hanging straight down to behind this big triangle behind your back, your hand at your hip or behind your hip. And then going forward is just a recoil till you're driving back again. So if your hands are in front of you, if you can see your hands the whole time, you know that they're too far forward. You've got to get back and get that. And to do that, for most of us, it requires strengthening. It mm-hmm. requires strengthening, you know, your shoulders and your whatever trapezius behind your back mm-hmm. and loosening in front, the chest and the shoulders. Chest.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just so you know, Jonathan, the folks listening probably know, but, you know, my background is in sports medicine, exercise science. I'm an athletic trainer by trade and a certified strength and conditioning yeah. specialist. So I get all of this and I try to express it, but I know sometimes the folks that listen, drown out my voice and they, you know, hear the voices of the people I'm talking to. So I'm glad to get your take on it. And it's stuff that I've been saying too, again. So guys, definitely the upper body, you know, you don't need to lift to look like Arnold or the world's strongest man or the world's strongest woman. That's not the goal, quite obviously. And you're not going to get that yeah. by accident. So, you know, doing some upper body strengthening, whether it's just with a TheraBand, whether you're at the gym, all those things that they do help with our running and just being healthier individuals. I mean, that's part of the name of the game
yeah.
too.
So just curious, what do you recommend as far as that strengthening to get the shoulders back into a neutral position? What type of strength work do you have people do?
You know, obviously it depends on what kind of, you know, accessibility. So if you have pull-up bars or lat pull downs, things like that, that's mm-hmm. great. Doing rows, whether it's a seated row, whether it's a bent over row with a dumbbell, again, whether it's with a TheraBand or a thick heavy resistance band, you can loop around your feet and just do a seated row, pulling back and pulling the shoulders back. And really, when you do that, don't just pull with your arms, but really when you get back, accentuate by trying to squeeze your shoulder blades together behind your back. So you're really opening the chest and working the, the rhombus or the rhomboids in the back of, you know, the center of your back to squeeze together. And then a real simple one is something that I've talked about before and here and there, but we call it eyes, Y's, and T's in the PT physical therapy type of world, where you're laying down on your stomach, laying prone, and you have your arms up overhead and you just raise, you know, raise both arms together, like thumbs up, basically position towards the ceiling, raise up and then back down and up and back down where you're contracting there. So that's the eye. And then you go out to like 45 degrees, which would be Y's, and doing the same thing, squeezing the shoulder blades together and then all the way out, to the T position. So your arms horizontal out from the body and up, doing the same thing, squeezing the shoulder blades together. And you can do that with no weights and you'll feel it. And as you get stronger, you add, I mean, just a couple, you know, 1 pound, 2 pound weights, or a, you know, can of soup in each hand, or whatever the case might be, if you need a little extra resistance. But you know, do 15, 20 of those, three sets of each, and you'll feel it. I promise you, in the upper back, and it works. It pulls your shoulder blades together and helps to open your chest, which is all exactly what we were just talking about, having your chest caved in and too tight in front and too weak in the back. So definitely important and beneficial exercises that you can do real easily at home with literally with, you know, no equipment, or you know, you get a TheraBand or something like that, and you're good to go.
Great. I will have the kids do it Friday.
it's good stuff. I mean, it really
you get
really
20
is.
Kids on the football field and they can do that. Yeah. It's enough. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So, and you're saying crack the walnut between your shoulder blades, right?
Yep. That's what you're aiming for. Yeah. Squeezing those shoulder blades together, because that's pulling the chest wide open and really working that those muscles in the center of your back is what we're trying to do. It helps with posture in daily life and certainly in running as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. I'm glad to do it. Hopefully, you know, your kids will go into it, but hopefully some of the people listening might take me up on it too. And if you do, certainly let me know how it's going for you. But Jonathan, as we're wrapping up today, my you know, the way I've been ending the episodes for the last 6 or 8 months now is with something I call a philosophical question. And it's just very open-ended. I've had folks that have answered with a couple of words. I've had folks that have answered with, you know, a couple of sentences and folks that, a few folks where I asked the question and 10 or 15 minutes later, they're still going. And I just kind of ask the question, get out of the way. And however you see fit to answer the question is fine. There's no right answers, no wrong answers. Just very much kind of your take on the question. I usually have a couple different options or a couple different things that I go with. But for somebody like you, who's been running for many years, I think you said 40 years of running in your life, or you know, certainly you're pretty much your whole life. What does just the sport of running and being a runner, what does that mean to you? What does the label of, you know, my name's Jonathan Beverly and I'm a runner. What does that, you know, again, as long or as short as you want it to be, but what does that kind of a statement or characterization, easy for me to say, mean in your words?
Wow, there's so many things that come to mind, as you imagine. But I think being a runner means somebody who has realized that the important thing in life is to be involved and be active, to be that. In order to be a runner, in my opinion, you have to be consistent. You've got to be out there, you know, most every day. And you're doing it often on your own. It's self, you know, self-initiative and self-enjoyment, that you're out, you can be alone with yourself. You can be, and you're alive and you're present here and now. So it's about being engaged with the world. There's a quote, Mark Helprin, Soldier of the Great War, where he says, if you really want to enjoy life, you must work quietly and humbly to realize your delusions of grandeur, which I think describes the running life. You know, the marathons and the races and things out there are part of our, you know, delusions of grandeur that we can be great somehow. But the real thing is the quietly and humbly, that, you know, it's the day to day being involved, being alive. You know, a day that you got in a run is a good day, and doesn't matter how, you know, how good the run was, but you were active. You were part of your living, your choosing and acting.
That's That's perfect. That's why I just get out of the way on those, because they go a bunch of different ways. But I think that's a great way to wrap things up, and a great, like I said, just a great way of what running means to you and what being a runner means to you. I love it. So once again, guys, jonathanbeverly.com is the website. The book's available there. The book's also available on Amazon. Is that pretty much the best place? Pretty much anywhere books are sold, but Amazon probably for most folks.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So jonathanbeverly.com, books on Amazon. Again, the title is Your Best Stride, and the book coming out later this fall. And maybe we'll talk about that one as well. Maybe we'll have you back for round two later the fall when the second book comes out. That one's Run Strong, Stay Hungry. And I believe you can pre-order that one on Amazon now too as well, right?
You can.
Okay, perfect. So all that stuff you can find on Amazon. We'll have the links as well. Twitter and Instagram, JBevRun is the way to connect to Jonathan and connect with him there. And again, once again, show notes, disruns.com/444. So Jonathan, thank you so much for the time today. Thank you for what is a great book. And I know it's going to help me, and I know it's going to help the folks that go out and get it and read it. So definitely check it out. Well done, and looking forward to hopefully staying in touch, and nothing but the best going forward. And maybe we can do this again sometime.
It was truly my pleasure, and I look forward to it. It'd be fun to keep in touch.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to today's episode of the show. I hope you enjoyed the conversation between Jonathan and myself. And as always, I would love to know what stood out to you from this episode. What was your big takeaway from our chat today? For me, I really think it comes down to this, and you're probably not going to be surprised about this, is when Jonathan talked about, you know, the stride, the shoe, pretty much everything that we talked about being, you know, down to the individual. What's the best thing that you can do? What's the best type of shoe? What's the best type of stride? It's what works for you. You know, how often do I say that there's no such thing as a one size fits all when it comes to your training, when it comes to goals, when it comes to anything? You know, I don't really believe in one size fits all at all, quite frankly. And this was a good reminder because, you know, to be quite honest, I've kind of been a big proponent, a big pusher of, you know, kind of a 4 foot, midfoot type of stride, because that's what works for me. That's what really changed my the trajectory of my quote unquote career in our sport. Quite honestly, if I didn't change to becoming more of a 4 foot, midfoot type of runner, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. I used to heel strike. And I used to hurt bad, and to the point where I was ready to quit. I was done with it. I hadn't really fallen head over heels in love with the sport at that point, and it was just hurting too much. So I was going to say the hell with it. And I happened to read an article that talked about landing more midfoot, forefoot, and I started trying it. And it took a while, but it worked, and it really was a game changer for me. And since then, I've been an evangelist. I've been a fan of, hey, if something's not working, you should try midfoot and forefoot type of striking, because it really worked for me. But that's the thing. It really worked for me. If what you're doing is working for you, then you don't need to change because of what worked for me. What you're doing is already working. And it's the same thing with shoes. I'm an ultra fan. You know that. But I know people that run in other types of shoes, and they work just fine. So again, it all comes down to doing what works for you, what feels good for you. If something's hurting, if something's not right, that's when it's time to try something different. All right. But if things are going well, keep on keeping on. And it was just a good reminder that again, that what works for me, and that's it. And what works for you is what's going to work for you. So that was my takeaway from today's episode. I would love to know what it was for you. What stood out to you from this episode? Let me know. Shoot me a tweet at DizRuns. Shoot me an email, DizRuns@gmail.com. Or better yet, head over to the show notes for this episode, which you can find at DizRuns.com/444. And you can leave a comment there. And that way it can add to the conversation as well. And you know, while we're kind of on the discussion of finding what's right for you, if you're looking for a pair of running shoes, head over to runningshoesguru.com and look at the reviews. Look at the shoes that you know that you have worked out, or that have worked for you in the past, and you can probably find several pairs that are similar. Or if you know something that doesn't work, you can check out the reviews of other shoes, and if it compares to that type of shoe, you know, hey, maybe this shoe isn't the right one for me as well. So runningshoesguru.com is sponsoring this episode. Great guys over there, and very appreciative of their support. So with that, we'll go ahead and put a bow on this thing today. Guys, thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope that you enjoyed it. It was a fun one for me, and I would definitely encourage you to check out Jonathan's book. It is a good one, and it's already paying dividends for me, and I would be surprised if you didn't find that it worked for you as well. So check that out. Your Best Stride is the title. There's links in the show notes, links that, you know, you obviously can get on Amazon as well. So until next time, guys, take care of yourselves. Thank you again for listening. Hope you have a great rest of the day, and we'll talk soon. Take care, guys.